Okay, so going forward on this chapter on sudden penetration, the chapter before was on the gradual path, and this is a bit more to do with an immediate path. And one of the things I was thinking of was the early years of Chithurst and Amaravati. Ajahn Sumedho used to begin his Dhamma talks, "Yesterday is a memory, future is unknown, now is the knowing." It's a beautiful, succinct way of putting this path. We can't be too worried or entangled about the past, or we have to understand it in its right perspective, same with the future, but certainly this now, this present, is about the quality of knowing, and that is where so many of the benefits of the practice really manifest. A central part of the direct path of the Buddha is, quote-unquote, letting go, or, quote-unquote, not clinging. This is something we must do in the present and recognize the result in the here and now. The degree to which we are able to let go, together with the correctness or appropriateness of that letting go, is what will determine its effect. When we let go of goodness and virtue, as in just dropping or neglecting them, that would tend to create more suffering and problems. When we let go of our destructive habits in a skillful way, it has a very different effect. Letting go of subtle obstructions has a more refined result. To continue with the image of the continental shelf of India, its gradual slope, then its sharp dropping off, there is a need to be laying the gradual foundation of practice firmly and to sharpen our discernment continually by monitoring our progress. But there is also a need to be looking for the point of letting go that leads to penetration. The Buddha continually pointed to wisdom as a central factor of the path. This underlies the training, as well as modulating the training so that it bears fruit in release. The Noble Eightfold Path begins with the wisdom factors, right view and right resolve. Five spiritual faculties of faith, effort, mindfulness, concentration, wisdom, culminate with wisdom. Any quote-unquote letting go has to rely on wisdom. And I think it is important to reflect on the, like in Pali, the word is banya, and it's translated as wisdom in English. And when we say wisdom in English, then it is grammatically, it's a noun, which means it's a thing, which starts to confuse matters already. Because we try to get this thing that we call wisdom, and in the word banya, it is a noun, but its root is a verb, pajanati. In English, that's called a gerund for all the English speakers. But it is important. It is a noun. Its actual root is a verb. So there's action implied in the word itself. So that's why Ajahn Jeff doesn't translate it as wisdom. He translates it as discernment. Because then what you've got is the act of discerning as a noun, but its actual root is a verb. And it's important because pajanati is like to know clearly, to know deeply. And wisdom is more the quality of knowing. So that rather than a solid thing, solid noun, well, wisdom. It's a subtle thing, but it's an important thing because wisdom is not something that we're trying to get. It's something that we're trying to use. Learning how to live with wisdom. Learning how to practice with wisdom. Learning how to discern the world around us with wisdom. So this sense of banya. That's a tangent that I think is important to reflect on. Because just as the footprints of all living beings that walk fit into the footprint of the elephant, and the elephant's footprint is declared to be their chief by reason of its size, so too, Among the steps that lead to enlightenment, the faculty of wisdom is declared to be their chief, that is, for the attainment of enlightenment. And that's from Samyutta 48, Sutta number 54. And then there's another one from Samyutta 48, Sutta number 45. It is bhikkhus, because he has developed and cultivated one faculty, that a bhikkhu who has destroyed the taints declares final knowledge thus. What is that one faculty? The faculty of wisdom. For a noble disciple who possesses wisdom, the faith that follows from it becomes stabilized. The energy that follows from it becomes stabilized. The mindfulness that follows from it becomes stabilized. The concentration that follows from it becomes stabilized. It is bhikkhus because this one faculty has been developed and cultivated that a bhikkhu who has destroyed the taints declares final knowledge thus. I understand. Destroyed is birth. The holy life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more for this state of being. Then I've got another passage from Ankutara 7, Sutta number 58. Here, Moggallana, a monk has learned this. Nothing is fit to be clung to. If a monk has learned that nothing is fit to be clung to, he directly knows everything. By directly knowing everything, he fully understands everything. When he fully understands everything, whatever feeling he experiences, be it pleasant, painful, or neither painful nor pleasant, in regard to those same feelings, he dwells contemplating impermanence, contemplating dispassion, contemplating cessation, contemplating relinquishment. When he thus abides contemplating impermanence, dispassion, cessation, and relinquishment in regard to those feelings, he does not cling to anything in the world. Without clinging, he is not agitated. Being unagitated, he personally attains nibbana. So this nugget of wisdom, this nugget of knowledge or knowing that the Buddha is pointing to is that nothing is fit to be clung to. It comes up in a few discourses where the Buddha is saying, yeah, if you just know this one thing, you understand, you get a handle on the whole path, the whole teaching. In Pali, it's sambedhammanalang abhinivesaya. Abhinivesaya is literally settling, making oneself at home. In usage, it means adherence to, sticking to, insistence. So abhinivesaya is to sort of cling or to stick or to hold on to. And then nalang is a negative. So all dhammas are not to be adhered to or clung to or stuck to. That's another teaching that Ajahn Buddhadasa sort of pointed out over and over again in his voluminous expositions on the Dhamma. He was great at reflecting on the suttas. And I thought I would read the whole sutta. It's from the Anguttara 7, sutta number 58. Although, for those who are going to look it up after, what I've got written down from whatever source I had before, in the new, this one is Ankutra 7, number 60. Oh, 61 actually. That's just some of the ways they're numbered, and depending on the translator and how old the translations were, how there's slight divergences. And it's a sutta that everybody almost certainly knows of. And the sutta is to Moggallana, and it begins with the Buddha going teaching the sleepy Moggallana how to overcome drowsiness. But then it transitions into fundamentals of conduct of a samana, a religious seeker, and then into the aspect of insight and wisdom. To me, it's a very interesting sutta. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling among the Bhagas, Sungsumarangira, in the deer park at Besakala Grove. Now, on that occasion, the Venerable Mahamoggallana was sitting and dozing at Kalawalamuttagama among the Magadans. With the divine eye, which is purified and surpasses the human, the Blessed One saw the Venerable Mahamoggallana sitting and dozing. Then, just as a strong man might extend his drawn-in arm or draw in his extended arm, the Blessed One disappeared from the deer park at Besakala Grove and reappeared before the Venerable Mahamoggallana. The Blessed One sat down on the seat that was prepared for him and said, "Are you dozing, Moggallana? Are you dozing, Moggallana?" "Yes, Bhante." "One, therefore, Moggallana, you should not attend to or cultivate the object that you were attending to when you became drowsy. By such means, it is possible that your drowsiness will be abandoned. Two, but if you cannot abandon your drowsiness in such a way, you should ponder, examine, and mentally inspect the Dhamma as you have heard it and learned it. By such means, it is possible that your drowsiness will be abandoned. 3. But if you cannot abandon your drowsiness in such a way, you should recite in detail the Dhamma as you have heard it and learned it. By such means, it is possible that your drowsiness will be abandoned. 4. But if you cannot abandon your drowsiness in such a way, you should pull both your ears and rub your limbs with your hands. By such means, it is possible that your drowsiness will be abandoned. 5. But if you cannot abandon your drowsiness in such a way, you should get up from your seat, rub your eyes with water, survey all the quarters, and look up at the constellations and stars. By such means, it is possible that your drowsiness will be abandoned. 6. But if you cannot abandon your drowsiness in such a way, you should attend to the perception of light. You should undertake the perception of day thus: as by day, so at night; as at night, so by day. Thus, with a mind that is open and uncovered, you should develop a mind imbued with luminosity. By such means, it is possible that your drowsiness will be abandoned. 7. But if you cannot abandon your drowsiness in such a way, you should undertake the exercise of walking back and forth, perceiving what is behind you and what is in front. This is doing walking, jonggrum, doing walking meditation. With your sense faculties drawn in and your mind collected. By such means, it is possible that your drowsiness will be abandoned. But if you cannot abandon your drowsiness in such a way, you should lie down on the right side in the lion's posture, with one foot overlapping the other, mindful and clearly comprehending. After noting in your mind the idea of rising, when you awaken, you should get up quickly, thinking, "I will not be intent on the pleasure of rest, the pleasure of sloth, the pleasure of sleep." It is in this way, Moggallana, that you should train yourself. Therefore, Moggallana, you should train yourself thus: we will not approach families for alms with a head swollen with pride. It is in this way, Moggallana, that you should train yourself. It may be, Moggallana, that a bhikkhu approaches families with a head swollen with pride. Now, there are chores to be done in the families, and for this reason, when a bhikkhu turns up, people may not pay attention to him. In such a case, the bhikkhu might think, "Who has turned this family against me? It seems that these people have now become indifferent toward me." In this way, through lack of gain, one feels humiliated. When feeling humiliated, one becomes restless. When one is restless, one loses one's restraint. The mind of one without restraint is far from concentration. Therefore, Moggallana, you should train yourself thus: we will not engage in contentious talk. It is in this way that you should train yourself. When there is contentious talk, an excess of words can be expected. When there is an excess of words, one becomes restless. When one is restless, one loses one's restraint. The mind of one without restraint is far from concentration. Moggallana, I do not praise bonding with everyone whatsoever, nor do I praise bonding with no one at all. I do not praise bonding with householders and monastics, but I do praise bonding with quiet and noiseless lodgings, far from the flurry of people, remote from human habitation, and suitable for seclusion. When this was said, the Venerable Maha Moggallana said to the Blessed One, "Briefly, Bhante, how is a bhikkhu liberated in the extinction of craving, best among devas and humans, one who has reached the ultimate conclusion, won ultimate security from bondage, lived the ultimate spiritual life, and gained the ultimate consummation?" Here, Moggallana, a bhikkhu has heard, nothing is worth holding to. When a bhikkhu has heard, nothing is worth holding to, he directly knows all things. Having directly known all things, he fully understands all things. Having fully understood all things, whatever feeling he feels, whether pleasant, painful, or neither painful nor pleasant, he dwells contemplating impermanence in those feelings, contemplating fading away in those feelings, contemplating cessation in those feelings, contemplating relinquishment in those feelings. As he dwells contemplating impermanence, fading away, cessation, relinquishment in those feelings, he does not cling to anything in the world. Not clinging, he is not agitated. Being unagitated, he personally attains Nibbana. He understands, destroyed his birth, the spiritual life has been lived, what had to be done has been done. There is no more coming back to any state of being. Briefly, Moggallana, it is in this way that a bhikkhu is best among devas and humans, one who has reached the ultimate conclusion, won ultimate security from bondage, lived the ultimate spiritual life, and gained the ultimate consummation. So, yeah, that's a very, to me, a very powerful statement, very beautiful description of the path and that implementation of wisdom and letting go. And the point of wisdom is not accumulating more knowledge, but how can I see things, perceive things, know things in a way that I'm ready to let go, ready to relinquish. In perceiving in that way or reflecting in that way, nothing is worth holding to, and understanding things, the contemplation is contemplating impermanence, contemplating dispassion, contemplating cessation, contemplating relinquishment. That's the last tetrad of the Anapanasati Sutta as well. So that, you know, whether it's implementing the faculty of reflection, investigation, and wisdom faculty, wisdom goes hand in hand with the cultivation of that mindfulness of breathing. Any questions about these various readings so far? Comments?
Comment that he goes really from some very basic aspects of training to almost kind of a graduated training in that sutta.
Yes, yes.
Really?
Yeah, it's definitely a gradual continental shelf dropping to sudden penetration. It's very beautiful. And, you know, there is this dealing with drowsiness. I mean, everybody deals with drowsiness. And then your basic deportment as a samana, as a religious seeker, and how to relate to the lay community, and then not getting involved in a whole lot of unnecessary talk, which ends up sort of contentious, proliferative, unsettling. And all of those, whether it's the relationship to the lay community and families, with talk, and then that sense of bonding with anybody. But also he says, nor do I praise bonding with no one at all. I mean, it's because he does say, of course, that association with Kalyanamitta is one of the major supports for the practice. How do you support each other as practitioners and not make things complicated and difficult for each other? But whatever it is, say becoming restless, inclines the mind to becoming more restless and then agitated and losing one's restraint, that calmness and centered quality, then you don't want to be feeding that. Yeah.
And then you mentioned about more of the physical remedy to reduce the dulcinness. But I think if there is a kind of mental fatigue or lack of joy, then also how could we actually attain some more energy to build up it?
Even in this, the Buddha is pondering, examining, mentally inspecting Dhamma. So like picking up a Dhamma theme and reflecting on it, that is a mental exercise to direct it there, rather than just trying to, in-breath, out-breath, in-breath, out-breath, picking up a theme, contemplating Four Noble Truths, contemplating the Seven Factors of Awakening, contemplating the Buddha said, nothing is worth adhering to. Well, what does that mean? And sort of picking that up as a theme to explore. So that's mental, engaging the mind in a skillful way. Or the Buddha says, like reciting in detail the Dhamma that one has learned and remembered. Here we chant the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, Adita Bariyaya Sutta. It's really helpful putting those into memory and then bringing them up for reflection as we're sitting. It's not a distraction. It's a way to energize the mind with the Dhamma and then to settle the mind on an object, especially if one is feeling a bit dull or drowsy. Because usually one's dull and drowsy and it's sort of drifty. It's kind of pleasant. But then you find yourself in this very dull state, which is not very fruitful for growing in practice.
One of the practical things in that sutta that I hadn't picked up early on before was just in the walking meditation instruction.
Right.
Where he says, perceiving what is in front as well and perceiving what is behind.
Right.
And I started to think, well, most of the time the perception is just always what's in front of you. And
yes.
Think that, if I kind of collect myself a little more, I can have more of an all-around awareness.
Yes, I mean, that's the sense of that sampajanya, is that sense of mindfulness of being around, because there is that tendency to just keep going forward all the time. We were talking about that when we were in town the other day, the pedestrian crosswalk. In America, a pedestrian crosswalk, the posture of the person walking is really kind of, their head is just sort of there, they're going forward. And it's kind of leaning into everything all the time. And it's very human, but it's particularly American. But in Britain and in Europe, the posture is way better.
They're walking upright.
So we just have to remember to just, be upright, be walking.
When the Buddha says in this section, don't completely isolate yourself, does that mean he's saying that you can't be a hermit and complete the path?
He's not very keen on being a hermit. It was certainly a mode of spiritual practice in the time of the Buddha and up to the present day in India. It's very common. That's exactly why the Buddha established the Sangha and set up this whole, it is an institution. But it's a model of mutual support, mutual encouragement, and mutual admonition, so that one has some mirror. And it doesn't mean one can't go into seclusion. The Buddha himself, even after being fully awakened, took time to go into seclusion. But it's usually for prescribed periods of time, for 3 months or for a month or something like that. And And then, you know, there are different personalities. Revata, I think, in the time of the Buddha, was known for his sort of, you know, being a bit more aloof and solitary. Certainly Mahakasapa was more of an ascetic monk, although he had a big following as well. Kind of like an Ajahn Mun, who was very kind of fierce and ascetic, but you know, people were drawn to him, so he had a big following. But the model that the Buddha used was much more having a community that don't get too entangled with each other, don't get caught up in each other, try to encourage each other, try to support each other, try to learn how to live harmoniously, letting go of your views and opinions. That's tough practice. Yeah.
So this was addressed to Venerable Moggallana.
Yes.
What sort of stage was he already an arahant?
He would not have been an arahant. An arahant was actually one of the last fetters to be dropped. I mean, because restlessness and just a bit more subtle. From the stories we received, mostly from the Vinaya actually, Mahamoggallana and Sariputta were friends, and they met the Buddha and gained faith in the Buddha, and then ordained under him. And after ordination, then Mahamoggallana took 2 weeks to become a fully awakened being. Sariputta was much slower. He took a month. These people were ripe. Because it was in Sariputta meeting, just an exchange, the Buddha. These two friends had this religious vocation, but they couldn't find a teacher that really gave them confidence. And then Sariputta saw the Buddha on alms round.
Asaji.
Oh, Asaji. Asaji, so now how did...
Then Asaji, I think, introduced them to...
Introduced them to
the teacher.
Okay, them to the teacher, okay. I'm trying to remember the story, why?
It's one of those occasions, again, where Sariputta, you know, sees Asaji, he's like, wow.
Oh, right, it was...
This wanderer's deportment is awesome. Let me ask him who his teacher is. And
right. Now it's starting to come back to me.
And so... As usual.
This is what happens with an old brain. Forget the details. There's a disciple of the Buddha, Asaji. And he's one of the first five.
First five, yeah.
He's one of the first five disciples. So he is on alms round, and Sariputta sees him, and wow, there's something special about this monk. And then tries to engage him in conversation to get tease out who's your teacher, what kind of teaching do you follow. And Asaji is much more of a bit more of a recluse and not so keen and engaging, and he gives a very short description, ye dhammahetu bhavava, all things arise from a cause, and the Buddha taught the cause of things and the cessation of the causes. And that much was enough for Sariputta to gain stream entry. And so then he came back and told his friend, Moggallana, and then the two of them went, and then Moggallana realized stream entry. Then the two of them went to the Buddha and asked to take training with him and ordained, and then 2 weeks later Mahamoggallana realized arahantship, and a month later Sariputta. Yeah, the story is in the Vinaya with a kind of a detailed description of that.
So this is from the first 2 weeks.
So this is early days of the Buddha's dispensation, and
a few months after he started teaching, that Sariputta and Moggallana came on the scene.
Yeah, it was within the first year. But I think it might even have been after the fire sermon. Okay, so it continues. A discourse in the Samyutta Nikaya. Well, this is from Samyutta 35, Sutta number 80. A sutta in the Sanyutta Nikaya also contains this same phrase, because the previous quote was from the Anguttara. It also contains this same phrase, nothing is fit to be clung to. The Pali Sabbe Dhamma Nalanga Bini Vaisaya. In this particular version, it is translated as nothing is worth adhering to. With this perception and attitude in mind, there can be a radical shift in how one relates to the world, and this shift then opens the way to freedom. But, Venerable Sir, how should a bhikkhu know, how should he see, for ignorance to be abandoned by him and true knowledge to arise? Here, bhikkhu, a bhikkhu has heard, nothing is worth adhering to. When a bhikkhu has heard, nothing is worth adhering to, he directly knows everything. Having directly known everything, he fully understands everything. Having fully understood everything, he sees all signs differently. Signs is nimitta. He sees the eye differently. He sees forms differently. He sees eye consciousness differently. He sees eye contact differently. He sees the feeling that arises from eye contact differently. He sees the ear, he sees the nose, he sees the tongue, he sees the body. He sees the mind differently. He sees mind objects differently. He sees mind consciousness differently. He sees mind contact differently. He sees the feeling that arises with mind contact as condition. That too he sees differently. When bhikkhu, a bhikkhu knows and sees thus, ignorance is abandoned by him and true knowledge arises. That's just an interesting permutation on that. Yeah.
That's not adhering to, same as not grasping.
Yeah, adhering to, sort of that sticking to, not clinging, not grasping. But it's like, upadana is the general word for clinging or grasping. That's the most common word. But of course, as in any language, sometimes there's different words that the Buddha uses as equivalents. So abhinivesaya is another equivalent to clinging, grasping, adhering, sticking to. Abhinivesaya is sort of like its primary meaning is like settling and making oneself at home with, which is interesting. Okay, we make ourselves at home with all sorts of delusions.
Cozy
and comfortable with our delusions. Yeah.
That sense of directly knowing everything, I think that's the same language that is used in Majjhima Nikaya 1, where it contrasts, where one perceives earth as earth.
Right.
And that's the not knowing.
Right.
Whereas the knowing is one directly knows earth as earth.
Right.
And Majjhima Nikaya 1 just exhaustively lists everything.
It's incredibly exhaustive, yeah. It's one of the longest suttas in the middle length discourses. But it's a great sutta. I mean, it's really important. It's a very, very important sutta. Yes?
So, for example, thinking. So the characteristic of thinking is that one joins another, and if you are not aware. So in this context, nothing is fit to be clung to. In practice, what does it mean? Does it mean that we step back, that we realize?
You get a perspective on thought, because in the Eightfold Path, there's right thought and there's wrong thought. Being able to step back far enough, because if you're clinging to it, then you're investing in its emotion or its correctness or its truth and reality. And so we get fully invested in it. Whereas if we're willing to not cling or not adhere to or not settle into it, then we can make a more clear assessment. Is this beneficial or not beneficial? Is this useful? Is it not useful? Is it true or not true? So then we can let go when we see, oh, this leads to suffering. Or we see, oh, this actually leads to deepened understanding and more clarity. So then you want to be able to apply the thought process then.
Apply the thought process meaning?
Well, then think skillfully.
Yeah.
Yeah, because when you're reflecting skillfully, then you're creating more clarity. There is a point, like in the, was it the Vedavitaka Sutta, the two kinds of thought? But then there is a point, even when you're thinking really skillfully, the mind gets tired. So then you still have to set that aside. But for most of us, that's down the road. But it's true. And once we do learn how to apply our mind, because that's, say, like Dhamma Vichaya is an enlightenment factor. It's like investigation of state. So it's like applying the thought processes to separating things out with investigation. But then also when it's not necessary to do all that investigation, then you can set it aside and just stay with a point of clarity and a point of stillness.
Like awareness.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. The non-clinging leading to release is not a blanket or indiscriminate letting go of everything. There needs to be discernment as to what is appropriate and what will facilitate the realization of the end of suffering. Ajahn Chah used the simile of purchasing a coconut to illustrate this point. And this is from Food for the Heart. The Buddha says we must practice by letting go. It's hard to understand this practice of letting go, isn't it? If we let go, then we don't practice, right? Because we've let go. Suppose you went to buy some coconuts in the market, and while you were carrying them back, someone asked why you bought them. I bought them to eat, you say. Are you going to eat the shells as well? No, I don't believe you. If you're not going to eat the shells, then why did you buy them too? Well, how are you going to answer? We practice with desire. If we didn't have desire, we wouldn't practice. Practicing with desire is tanha. Contemplating in this way can give rise to wisdom, you know. As for those coconuts, of course you are not going to eat the shells. Then why do you take them? Because the time hasn't yet come for you to throw them away. They're useful for wrapping up the coconut. If after eating the coconut you throw the shells away, there's no problem. Our practice is like this. When the Buddha instructs us not to act on desire, speak from desire, or walk or sit or eat with desire, he means we should do these things with detachment. It's just like bringing coconuts from the market. We're not going to eat the shells, but it's not yet time to throw them away. The coconut milk, the husk, and the shell all come together. When we buy a coconut, we buy the whole package. If somebody wants to accuse us of eating coconut shells, that's their business. We know what we're doing. This is how the practice is. So it's sort of Ajahn Chah's typical kind of earthy way of taking a mundane activity and using it to illustrate a Dhamma principle. I think it's quite important in that sense of the letting go is not, yeah, it's not letting go of absolutely everything. There's still the practice to be done. There's still the aspects of, say, right speech, right action, right mindfulness, right effort to be attended to. But we approach it with a sense of not clinging, not adhering, not getting entangled in the kind of, oh, I got to get results like this or that, and then the that sense of the usefulness of we've still got our preferences, we've still got our desires, we've still got our body and mind. You have to learn how to make use of them in the most skillful way possible. And so. Okay, next is, so what is to be let go of? The Buddha points to four basic types of clinging, upadana, that lead to entanglement and suffering. And the word upadana is also, I mean, it's translated as clinging. It also has the connotation of fuel, that fuel, you know, like putting fuels on the fires of attachment and clinging. It also has the connotation of nutriment, or like a food, something that feeds, you know, feeds more suffering and stress. So that feeding dukkha, so that being able to identify these types of clinging, and then recognize all of that can be relinquished. When we are able to relinquish these forms of clinging and the ignorance on which they are based, the heart has the opportunity to experience freedom. I have a quote from Majjhima 11, which is the Chula Sihanada Sutta. It's the lesser discourse on the lion's roar, the Buddha giving a lion's roar to his teaching. This is the real deal. Because when ignorance is abandoned and true knowledge has arisen in a bhikkhu, then with the fading away of ignorance and the rising of true knowledge, he no longer clings to sensual pleasures, kaham upadana, no longer clings to views, dit upadana, no longer clings to rules and observances, sila bat upadana, no longer clings to a doctrine of self, attavad upadana. When he does not cling, he is not agitated. When he is not agitated, he personally attains nibbana. He understands. Birth is destroyed. The holy life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more coming to any state of being. These four bases of clinging, of attachment, are as a theme for investigation, applying our thought processes. So what am I attaching to? What am I getting entangled in? These are really important to investigate and see, and to say, how can I relinquish that? How can I disentangle myself from this? And of course, kama upadana, the sense of attachment, clinging, adherence. It's not that one doesn't experience something pleasurable as pleasurable. It's just that you don't sort of invest in, I've got to have it, I got to get it. I'm going to miss it. And you know that fretting over not getting it. And it's not the actual pleasurable sensation itself. It's the desire and attachment towards it. Clinging to views, you know, this is absolutely right, this is absolutely wrong, this is the way it has to be. The sense of view of ditti is tangled up with the sense of self as well, self and other, and so that the things that divide us, say like I'm Canadian, grew up Canadian, there's those bloody Americans. How do you live in the world with them? It's just ditty.
So. And now you're American too.
Well, I've got an American passport. So I'm responsible as well. So we have views, our societal views and cultural views and personal views that we pick up along the way. And it's important to recognize a view as a view. And when we cling to them, then we create suffering. Sila bat upadana, no longer clings to rules and observances. Another old translation would have been clinging to rites and rituals. Sila bat, the clinging is to the assumption that if I just kept this set of rules, if I just did this kind of practice, I would get purity from that. I would be enlightened through that. If I just watched my breath long enough, I did anapanasati long enough, I would get enlightened. If I just kept all the rules absolutely right, if I just kept the vinaya just right. And it's not that one doesn't keep the precepts or keep the rules of training. It's not that one doesn't do the meditation, but it's the assumption that I've got to get this right in order for me to be awakened or enlightened. And it's that clinging to it that is the obstruction itself. These are tools that we have to learn how to apply. And then atta-vādhu-upādāna, it's not atta-upādāna, it's atta-vādhu-upādāna. The atta is self. Vada is a doctrine or an assumption. So that clinging to an assumption of self, clinging to a doctrine of self, a teaching about self, because this is what self is, this is what soul is, this is your true nature. Those are doctrines and beliefs and assumptions. And it's that belief and the clinging to that that is the obstacle. Because the Buddha never really said, categorically stated, that there isn't a self. It's just, actually it says, atahi atanonato, the self is the refuge of the self. So it's like, there is this being here that you have to learn how to use properly without clinging to it. It arises and ceases, it's empty, it's insubstantial. But it says that, one can't cling to it. Okay, we'll wrap it up. It's after 7 already.